Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On June 29, 2020, the Supreme Court decided Sela Law LLC versus Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, a case that raised separation of power questions regarding the structure of the Bureau. Specifically, the court ruled on whether Congress's law that created the Bureau can stipulate that the President could not remove the Bureau's director at will. Sela Law, a law firm based in California specializing in debt relief services, was being investigated by CFPB after allegedly violating telemarketing sales rules. Sela Law challenged the Bureau's authority to investigate their firm, maintaining that CFPB's structure, namely its director's immunity from at-will removal by the president, was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 in favor of the firm, finding Congress's insulation of the director from being removed at will by the president does indeed violate the separation of powers. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, in which Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh joined. Justice Kagan filed an opinion concurring in the judgment with respect to severability and dissented in part, in which Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor joined. Joining us to discuss this decision and its implications are John Eastman, Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service, and Director at the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence at Chapman University Fowler School of Law, along with Brian Johnson, partner at Alston & Byrd.
Talking today about the Supreme Court's decision in Sela Law, not unexpectedly finding that the single director unaccountable to the president or anybody else in the world format that Congress set up with the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau was an unconstitutional restriction on the president's executive authority conveyed by Article 2 of the Constitution. Interestingly, the opinion so holding garnered 5 votes written by Chief Justice John Roberts, who has the opinion for the court, joined by Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Kavanaugh in parts 1, 2, and 3 of his opinion. This is an extremely significant case for administrative law and separation of powers and kind of getting us back on the right track for constitutional separation of powers as the Constitution mandates and certainly envisioned. The case that went got us on the wrong path was a New Deal era case called Humphrey's Executor. Now, Humphrey's Executor had largely ignored immediately prior precedent where the Supreme Court held that the president's executive power, which is conveyed upon him, the executive power, a unitary executive idea in Article 2, necessarily implied that he had the power to remove executive officers, even those that had been nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate, that the Senate confirmation process was an exception to the executive power otherwise broadly granted. And then unless the exception was specific, the general rule of executive power would be invested in the president would prevail. Humphrey's Executor changed that and really laid the groundwork for the administrative state of independent, unelected, and largely unaccountable agencies running large swaths of the nation's economy and controlling large aspects of our lives. Humphrey's Executor, though, involved a multi-member commission at the Federal Trade Commission with staggered terms. And the court there held that because it exercised more quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial powers rather than core executive powers, that it was permissible for Congress to constrain the president's removal authority for the members of that multi-member commission. Now, that distinction between quasi-legislative and quasi-judicial powers on the one hand and purely executive powers on the other was blown out of the water when the Supreme Court half a century later decides Morrison versus Olson, which was an independent prosecutor exercising purely executive powers that could not be removed by the president, and the court upheld that as well. Chief Justice Roberts distinguishes both of those cases here. Humphrey's executor was a multi-member commission, the CFPB, is headed by a single director. And Morrison was an inferior officer, whereas the CFPB is headed by a director who's clearly a superior or constitutional officer. And you know, the big question and the dispute between Chief Justice Roberts and the concurring opinion by Justice Thomas, or the opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part, is whether to overrule Humphrey's executor outright as finding no basis in the Constitution, and in fact really undermining this core separation of powers principle. Thomas, of course, as is his wont, and in this he was joined by Justice Neil Gorsuch, would overrule Humphrey's executor as wrongly decided. But he says that this opinion goes a pretty long way in accomplishing that. Quote, the court has repudiated almost every aspect of Humphrey's executor. In a future case, I would repudiate what is left of this erroneous precedent. And just in case anybody misconstrued what he's talking about here, he says that decision has paved the way for an ever-expanding encroachment on the power of the executive, contrary to our constitutional design. It represented a fundamental departure from our constitutional structure, with nothing more than hand-waving and obfuscating phrases such as quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial. Now, where does dispute lie in Justice Thomas's opinion concurring there is also a dissenting opinion in part, and that is on the question of severability. And here, Chief Justice Roberts, at this point writing for himself, Justice Alito and Justice Kavanaugh, and then joined just with an aside by the four liberals, Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor, says that we need to reach the question of whether the appointment or removal authority provision is severable so that the rest of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau remains intact. And in fact, as I expect, and Brian will be taking this up more, may end up continuing to operate as if nothing happened here. And Chief Justice Roberts ends up saying it is in fact severable, and the remainder of the CFPB therefore stays in place, remands the case back to the Ninth Circuit to decide whether, in the brief period when the CFPB was headed by an acting interim director who was removable by the president, that necessarily amounted to a constitutional ratification of the order, the investigative order that CFPB sought to enforce against Sayla Law, the plaintiff in this case. And so we'll have a remand for that. But here's my concern. There are several other aspects of the CFPB that I think are equally constitutionally troubling. The CFPB gets funding completely outside of the constitutional appropriation process. In fact, it has a double insulation from that constitutional appropriation process that gives Congress some oversight authority over executive agencies. It gets to raise its own money by tapping into the funds from the Federal Reserve, which itself gets to raise its own money by participating banks in the Federal Reserve system. All of this, I think, is a blatant violation of Article 1, Section 9's requirement that appropriations only be done by act of Congress. The second thing, and this goes to the heart of one of the big questions in Humphrey's executor that was not addressed then and doesn't and is still not addressed, at least not by the majority opinion. And that is a single agency that exercises rulemaking authority and enforcement authority and adjudicative authority, as Chief Justice Roberts acknowledges this agency does. In fact, he calls it extensive rulemaking, enforcement, and adjudicative authority. Why does that not itself violate the separation of powers provisions of the Constitution. Congress is supposed to be the one that exercises lawmaking power. The executive, the president, is supposed to be the one that exercises enforcement authority. And the courts are supposed to be the ones that adjudicate individual rights under the exercises of those two authorities. None of that exists with the CFPB. And it didn't exist with Humphrey's executors either. Calling it quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial didn't solve the problem. It exacerbated it. And yet that seems to be the norm, that by saying this one removal provision is unconstitutional, but severing it from the rest and allowing the remainder of the statute to stay in place kind of ratifies those unconstitutional intrusions on our structural constitutional design. And that's my greatest fear, that on remand we'll just kind of pretend none of that's there. The court having spoken, we'll just now have some modicum of presidential oversight authority that I can remove for will rather than merely for cause. But all the rest of those real troubling aspects of the CFPB and a number of numerous other unaccountable agencies, to use another phrase from Justice Thomas's separate opinion, will continue to go on as if nothing else happened. Now, one thing I want to say about Justice Kagan's dissent, she concurs, of course, in the question of severability, but she dissents otherwise, and she's joined in that by Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Sotomayor. She does say something that I think is very significant. She says nothing in the Constitution speaks of the removal power of the president. Well, on that, she's bucking up against the old Myers decision and the famous decision of 1789 in Congress, that the president, by assigning the executive power to the president, he necessarily has to be able to control his subordinates. Otherwise, he's not the one with exercising the executive power or being able to take care that the Constitution be faithfully executed as his oath of office requires. But she rightly recognizes, I think, that there really, in principle, is no difference on the separation of powers problem between a single member or a multi-member agency. You know, in fact, I think she makes a pretty interesting argument that a single member agency might be more susceptible to the president's cajoling authority, the bully pulpit authority, if you will, than a multi-member agency might be, because their accountability for their actions is more diffuse. But the principle here, that the president has to be able to wield supervisorial authority over anyone exercising executive power, doesn't seem to turn on whether the person exercising that power is a single member or a multi-member commission. And I think she's right about that. And I wish the court majority and Chief Justice Roberts' opinion had taken that issue up with greater certainty. It was easy to say, well, Humphrey's executor dealt with a multi-member commission. This is a single director, and therefore they're different. But I think Justice Kagan in dissent makes a pretty persuasive argument that they're not different on the principle that's at issue here. Now, she would say they both should be upheld, and I would say they both should fall, but that seems to be the logic that needs to be addressed here. Justice Thomas has, of course, invited that in future cases to more explicitly overrule Humphrey's executor outright, but that seems to be where things are going. Now, with that, I'd like to pass it to Brian, and he can address what he thinks, I mean, how the CFPB is actually going to work on the ground, how it works on the ground, and what impact this decision might have and what we might expect to see on remand. Take it away.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here with you and for all the listeners, and appreciate the invitation from the Federal Society. By way of background, as recently as March, I was not in private practice, but instead was serving as deputy director of the CFPB. So I have some insight from 2 years of service at the agency on what I think might be the practical implications of yesterday's decision on agency operations. And as John, you mentioned, in one sense, it's business as usual. However, I think there are some important changes that may result from yesterday's decision. And I'll start, I guess, by picking up on your discussion of severability and point to, I think, an important and interesting observation that Justice Thomas made in his concurrence in part and dissent in part, his dissent on severability, and that's that the this case or controversy arose because of the interaction of two different statutory provisions. And one was, of course, the conditions on removal of the director under Title 10 of Dodd-Frank. And the second was the statutory authority granted to the director to enforce a CID. And it was SELA law's resistance to the Bureau's CID and the Bureau's subsequent resort to federal court to try and enforce that CID that gave rise to the original controversy. And of course, SELA then argued that the Bureau is unconstitutionally structured because of the conditions on removal. And Justice Thomas, I think, rightfully notes in his dissent regarding severability that there are two provisions here that could be severed from the statute, but the severance of either one of which would resolve the conflict here. And the majority opinion on severability neither really recognizes that nor grapples with which of the two statutory provisions should be selected, and certainly no conditions or rule is enunciated that would govern how a court or the court would choose between those two. And so Thomas, I think, makes the observation that rather arbitrarily or because of the majority's preference, they simply selected the conditions on removal and chose to sever those provisions rather than the authority of the director to enforce a CID, which would have equally resolved the matter, at least from SELA law's perspective. So that gets to, what are the practical implications of the court's decision to sever the conditions on removal? As I mentioned, in one sense, it's business as usual. A more modest, in one view, resolution of the matter would have been for the court to simply decline to enforce the CID, but not address severability. That would have resolved the matter for SELA, but left the matter open for other institutions that are subject to the Bureau's jurisdiction. That would have permitted additional challenges, of course, to agency enforcement actions, but would have, I think, stood a better chance of spurring congressional action in response to address many of the institutional infirmities that John, you addressed earlier with regard to budget independence and other matters. So severability saved the Bureau from the effort of having to defend itself from those arguments and successive challenges to its authority. But what it did, I think, is, for all intents and purposes, make the director answerable to the president. Director Kraninger now effectively serves at the will of President Trump, and future directors will serve at the will of future presidents. So what are the practical implications for the Bureau today? One, I'd say at the outset, is it was foreseeable that Director Kraninger, in joining the position of DOJ and arguing that the agency's structure was unconstitutional, that the most likely outcome would be that there is now a substantial risk that her tenure as director could be cut short in light of this fall's presidential election. So I would note that it takes some degree of courage to stand on principle and to make that argument, recognizing that it certainly is not in her immediate personal interest. I'd say there are two other foreseeable consequences. First, I believe the president could now insist that the CFPB, as a formerly independent executive agency, follow all executive orders. Those executive orders include, of course, 12866, which is robust cost-benefit analysis that would attach to any agency rulemaking, and certainly many others, including executive orders issued by President Trump under the present administration. The second is an issue that, John, you touched on earlier, which relates to the budget. And as you mentioned, the CFPB is not appropriated. It draws its funds, no questions asked, from the Fed in an amount determined by the director on a quarterly basis to be, quote, reasonably necessary to carry out the Bureau's authorities. So now that the director serves at the pleasure of the president, an interesting question arises, which is, what if those two individuals have a difference of opinion about what is the amount that is reasonably necessary to carry out the Bureau's authorities? And I mention that because the president's budget request for fiscal 2021, which begins October 1st of this year, established, or would, if enacted by Congress, establish a budget cap of $485 million. To the contrary, Director Kraninger's projected budget for the next fiscal year is $595.2 million. So that's $110 million difference of opinion each year, presumably, moving forward. So whose opinion prevails there? I think it's clear that the president's opinion prevails to the extent there's a disagreement about resource needs for the agency. And I think one foreseeable consequence of the sale of law case is that OMB could reach out to CFPB and order CFPB tomorrow, for instance, to draw up plans to bring its budget into harmony with the president's budget request for the next fiscal year. Or hypothetically, a president could signal to Congress that he will maintain a budget for a certain period of time and then zero out that budget as a means of encouraging Congress to appropriate the agency and present it with a choice of whether to engage in appropriations and bring the agency into the regular budget process or permit it to shut down. That's, of course, an outer bound, I think, of the president's authority, but nonetheless, a foreseeable way to engage with Congress in the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.